Hollywood has long had a love affair with real-life gangsters. John Dillinger, Bonnie and Clyde, Pretty Boy Floyd, Babyface Nelson. A few decades ago, there was a crime boss in France who captured the public imagination just the same way. His name was Jacques Mérine, and he's captured in film, too. The new movie is Mérine, Killer Instinct. Our critic Bob Mondello says this French bad guy gives his American rivals a cinematic run for their money.
Jacques Mérine is cold-blooded, hot-tempered, brutal, and wields a killer smile. This biopic, adapted from a memoir that Mérine wrote while in jail, takes him from shooting unarmed rebels in Algiers to robbing banks and kidnapping a wealthy employer in Canada to breaking out and then back into a supposedly escape-proof prison. The filmmakers never even remotely try to make him appealing, but they sure make him seductive. At one point, they have him dancing with a woman who'll soon be his wife. Sexy, slow, and somehow he's also dancing with the camera. As she melts in his arms, the audience gets caught up in his embrace. Then Mérine returns to his whore, slaughters a pimp, buries a guy alive, and you think, oh yeah, there's that side of it. Jacques Mérine is played by Vincent Cassel, a tall, lanky French star whose intensity is a lot like that of the young Gérard Depardieu. That comparison occurs to me because Depardieu is in this picture, playing a gentlemanly older thug who takes Mérine under his wing and tries to show him how to keep violence and his domestic life separate. Doesn't work. The violence escalates even as Mérine becomes a father, and escalates more when he meets a prostitute who says she's up for anything and becomes a Bonnie to his Clyde. The real Mérine was known as a man of a thousand faces, and the film, or rather films, the second of which arrives in theaters next month, cover the whole of his criminal career. Director Jean-François Richer shot this picture, Mérine Killer Instinct, and the next one, Mérine Public Enemy Number 1, in one long epic shoot across 9 months and several continents. And though there was some talk about condensing the two parts into a single film for American audiences, wiser heads have prevailed. Richer and his screenwriter, who also wrote the terrific French gangster film A Prophet, so he's having a pretty good year, make it a point not to glorify their subject, but that doesn't keep Killer Instinct from playing like a classic gangster flick. This is still the upward half of the story arc, remember? He's still hitting his criminal stride. The fall and paranoia will come in the next part when he becomes Public Enemy Number 1, and anyone who sees this half is going to be clamoring to catch that half on opening day. I'm Bob Mondello.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. When Captain John Smith entered the Chesapeake Bay in the summer of 1608, he found oysters in abundance. He wrote in his journal, "They lay as thick as stones." By the 1800s, watermen were harvesting millions of bushels of oysters every year. Chesapeake oysters became a delicacy served in the country's finest restaurants. But the succulent shellfish have been loved almost to extinction. Overfishing, disease, and pollution have left the Chesapeake with only about 1% of the oysters it had back then. Now scientists and business people are making some headway in bringing them back for the sake of oyster lovers and the bay. We hear that story from NPR's Elizabeth Shogren.
Marine biologist David Schulte has been trying to engineer a recovery for the bay's oysters, starting with one of its small tributaries. We set anchor over one of the reefs he built on Virginia's Great Wicomico River, and he sends what looks like a lime green canister vacuum cleaner overboard. It's a remote-controlled submarine. Schulte's theory was, if you build it, and build it big enough, they will come. And for the past several years, baby oysters have been coming by the millions to his reefs.
Now that's a great shot right there.
He's peering at a screen at lots of craggy shells standing on end in the murky brown water.
Those oysters are all growing very vertically, very densely packed together. Really, this was the first time this was documented in the Chesapeake Bay in over a century.
1,000 oysters per square meter. That's what nature used to provide, but no one had been able to mimic it. Schulte says his restoration project is working where many others failed because he came up with a radically new recipe. After studying successful restoration projects in other parts of the world, he decided he had to build reefs much larger than earlier efforts. Instead of 1 acre, his was 100 acres. And after reading historic accounts of what oyster reefs once looked like, he decided his reefs had to be higher. So he piled up enough shell to stick up a foot or more from the river bottom, instead of a few inches. He hoped that would prevent the oysters from being smothered by the muck, like in previous experiments.
And it turns out that from all the data that we've got, I was right.
Why would that be controversial?
It hadn't been done, and it's more expensive.
Schulte works for the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, and he got $3 million for his project. He says his experiments should be scaled up across the bay to restore the Chesapeake oyster. But lots of other scientists are skeptical. Professor Roger Mann of the Virginia Institute of Marine Science says it would be wildly expensive.
Once you get into trying to do restoration in very large rivers, the quantities of shell that are needed and the dollars that are involved in it get to be extraordinary. And before you start spending those amounts, you need to be absolutely sure that your recipe that you're using is right.
Mann is showing me a hatchery at his university where he and other scientists are breeding oysters. In one room, several huge vats are filled with vividly colored water, one lemon yellow, one pea green, and others different shades of brown.
What you see here is increasing concentrations of algae. This is the food factory for the oysters.
Oysters eat lots of algae. That's what makes them so valuable to the bay. Scientists estimate that there used to be so many oysters in the Chesapeake that they could filter the whole bay in several days. Now it takes the few oysters that are left about a year to do the same job. Mann believes the best way to bring back oysters is to promote a new industry on the Chesapeake, oyster farming. That way, businesses, not taxpayers, will be footing the bill to put millions of the filter feeders back in the bay.
There's a lot of very clever people who are in this industry who are willing to work hard to build their oyster farms, and in doing so, I think, can have really positive ecological effects.
People like Ryan Croxton. Croxton is counting oysters he just pulled from cages in Virginia's Rappahannock River. Croxton started oyster farming with his cousin several years ago. His grandfather used to supply oysters to Campbell Soup. But no one had harvested for many years, and the family was about to lose leases it had to work the river.
We wanted to keep the lease alive. It had been in our family since the 1890s. And that's when we realized that there was kind of a disconnect in the way we were doing it and the way we ought to be doing it.
His grandfather's teams dragged big dredges across the bottom of the river, ripping up the habitat as they went. The Croxtons now grow oysters in cages. They started the farm so they could have a private stash, but they loved the product so much that they decided to aim big.
So we got a Zagat guide, and we looked at the number one restaurant in New York City, which was La Bernardin, and just called the reservation line. I mean, it's easy to be bold when you got nothing to lose. And we're able to get an audience with the chef and showed him the oyster. He absolutely loved it.
Now they sell 30,000 to 40,000 oysters a week for the half-shell market.
And what about the practices that your grandfather used? What do you think about them now?
that's my blood, so I got to be careful. But I do feel bad about the techniques that they used. We've completely abandoned all of them.
Croxton says instead of tearing down the bay like his predecessors, his operation is helping revive it. He takes me out to see his farm, a line of cages in the Rappahannock's choppy water. Croxton says there's no question that the hundreds of thousands of oysters below us are helping remove pollution.
I mean, each one of these oysters is filtering like 50 to 60 gallons of water a day.
So I'll hop in and pull up a clump of these oysters.
Tommy Leggett agrees that operations like Croxton's do some good. Leggett's an oyster farmer, too. But he also heads up oyster restoration in Virginia for the environmental group Chesapeake Bay Foundation. And he's become a believer in big-scale restoration projects. Thanks to a mini version he built on a tiny creek.
So here's one shell in my hand with three nice oysters on it. And this is all wild oysters from the creek.
Leggett says he hoped some wild baby oysters would settle on the mound of shells he dumped into the creek, but he's been thrilled by how many mature oysters have made this their home. He says large restoration projects would be less likely to fail because of threats like sediment and predators, and would be well worth the high price tag.
We're not going to restore the Chesapeake Bay without oysters, period. It's one of the most important cleaners of the bay that we have.
And Leggett says now is a good time to make big public investments in rescuing oysters. His group recently came out with a report documenting that fewer oysters are dying from two diseases that have long plagued them and suggesting that they may be developing some resistance. This is good news for oyster farmers and the bay. Elizabeth Shogren, NPR News.
All Things Considered is a production of NPR News, which is solely responsible for its content. You can connect with NPR and your favorite member station, wherever you are. Get the NPR app for your mobile device. You can also lean back and enjoy NPR.org, optimized for the iPad. This is NPR.
California is the first state to pass legislation setting up a key component of the new federal health law. It's unclear if Governor Schwarzenegger will sign it, but if he does, he would establish a new state agency that would bargain with health insurers on behalf of consumers. The bill would also set up a website where people could compare and purchase coverage. That kind of negotiating power would dramatically change the way individuals and small businesses buy coverage now. From member station KQED, Sarah Varney has this report.
The modern American cereal aisle is a testament to the free market and unbridled consumer choice. All these towering boxes of smiling leprechauns, amped up bunnies, and glistening raisins. It seems like these cereal aisles grow taller and longer each week.
When there are too many choices that are too hard to compare, generally consumers sort of give up on trying to be real thoughtful about it.
If you're overwhelmed with cereal, try comparing health insurance plans, says Rick Curtis. He's president of the Institute for Health Policy Solutions, a nonpartisan research group. The new federal health law gives states wide latitude in setting up what amount to online health insurance superstores. And the question is, how much help should states offer shoppers? California lawmakers have chosen to make it as easy as possible for consumers. They want to set up a government agency with considerable powers to shape the marketplace. Curtis says although the federal health law sets minimum benefits and caps out-of-pocket costs, the California Insurance Exchange would standardize the products for consumers even more.
It will make it easier for them to compare if it's an apples-to-apples comparison, that they don't have to figure out if the plans from Anthem have a $50 higher deductible and a 5% lower cost-sharing requirement for ambulatory services. And so how do I compare these things?
Instead, says Curtis and other health policy experts, Californians could compare plans that are essentially identical and shop based on price, service, and quality. The bills passed this week would also give the independent board running the exchange broad authority to negotiate the price of plans sold in this new health insurance superstore. It's similar to the negotiating clout large employers have now when insurance carriers want to earn their business, says Anthony Wright, head of the Sacramento-based consumer advocacy group Health Access.
That is not a power that individual consumers have. You know, right now, individuals are left all alone at the mercy of the insurers. But if the exchange can represent the several million Californians who will be getting covered to the exchange, they will be able to negotiate a much better deal.
Some 4 million people, including individuals and small businesses, could get coverage through the exchange when it opens in 2014. Not everyone is happy, though. Anthem Blue Cross, the largest provider of individual health insurance in California, strongly opposes the power given to the exchange's governing board. The company would not comment, but in a letter to state senators, warned consumers could end up with fewer choices. Still, many insurers see a chance to confront rising health care costs, which they say threaten their long-term viability. Mark Weideman is with the nonprofit carrier Blue Shield of California. He says insurers will have to disclose somewhat how much they're paying for medical care.
That information is going to be very helpful to consumers because I think people would be extremely surprised if they realized how much we're paying hospitals, how much we're paying physicians, how much we're paying drug companies.
Weideman and some health economists suspect, or perhaps just hope, that consumers might choose a lower-cost hospital or physician if they're of equally good quality. That's still a long way off, though. The bills determining the future of California's insurance superstore are awaiting action on the governor's desk. For NPR News, I'm Sarah Varney.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. More evidence today that the economic recovery is running out of gas. The government released a new estimate for growth in April, May, and June, saying the economy expanded at an annual rate of just 1.6%. And today, Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke acknowledged the recovery has weakened more than expected. In a much-anticipated speech, he said the Fed stands ready to take additional action if necessary. But, as NPR's John Itzdee reports, he gave no indication that new action by the Fed is imminent.
Bernanke spoke at the Fed's annual summer retreat in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. No video or audio recording of his speech was allowed. But in it, Bernanke acknowledged the economy's weakness, saying that growth has been, quote, less vigorous than expected. But he also rejected the growing notion that the economy is headed to a double-dip recession, saying, quote, I expect the economy to continue to expand in the second half of this year, albeit at a relatively slow pace. He did outline several options the Fed has to support the economy if necessary. John Sylvia, chief economist at Wells Fargo, says those looking for immediate Fed action were probably disappointed.
There was a lot of buildup to this, and I think expectations were too high that the Fed would take immediate action to pump up the economy.
One of those who was disappointed was economist Dean Baker, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington.
This is really a pretty awful situation, and that's what I just don't think he seems to appreciate. I mean, we're looking at 9.5% unemployment, most likely rising through the rest of this year and certainly not coming down anytime soon.
Baker says the slowdown in growth could even morph into a contraction in the economy in the coming months, the so-called double dip. But John Sylvia says the dire predictions we've been hearing lately are unlikely to materialize.
I understand that there are some people who think the economy really is deteriorating rapidly, going into a double dip, or the, you know, basically a depression. I hear those voices. I don't think that reflects the evidence.
Sylvia acknowledges the slowdown in growth this spring to a 1.6% annual pace is disappointing. But he says there's evidence in today's GDP report of steady growth in demand that will keep the worst fears for the economy from being realized. But Baker says growth this slow still presents big problems.
This isn't fast enough to even create jobs. We have to grow about 2%, close to 2% just to create any jobs, and probably at least 2.5% to keep the unemployment rate from rising. So we're really going the wrong way here.
Baker says that he was disappointed that during his speech, Chairman Bernanke took off the table the idea of the Fed setting a higher target for inflation. Baker argues that could boost business investment and wages and ultimately reduce household debt over the next 3 to 4 years. While he's not as gloomy as Baker, John Sylvia agrees the Fed will decide this fall that growth is too slow and take action to speed things up after the November election. Sylvia thinks the Fed will use one of the three options Bernanke outlined in his speech this morning, namely putting money into the economy through the purchase of securities like government treasuries or mortgage-backed bonds. Sylvia says part of the reason the Fed is hesitant to act now is that it doesn't want to appear to be panicked into a move.
But I think the more reasonable view is that the Fed is there. They are ready. They do understand that there's a problem, and they will act sometime in the future. And I think that helps to, you know, get the market back on track.
Indeed, after a brief sell-off initially, the stock market surged following Bernanke's speech, and the bond market reflected greater confidence that the economic recovery will continue. John Idstey, NPR News, Washington.
Today's markets aside, it has been a week of bad economic news, and that means more trouble for the Obama administration as we head toward November's midterm elections. Joining me to talk politics, as we do most Fridays, are E.J. Dionne of The Washington Post and David Brooks of The New York Times. Welcome back to you both. Good to see
Thank you.
Good to see you.
David, let's start with you. We just heard that Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke's message was he expects the economy to continue to expand at a relatively slow pace, slow expansion. To those who would say, look, we need more urgent action from the Fed, from the administration, you would say no.
No. I would say from the Fed, we need more action. I think what we've learned over the last year is monetary policy is the way you pump up the economy when you need to. Fiscal policy doesn't work so well. We've tried that with a big stimulus package. This was supposed to be the summer of recovery. The administration predicted we'd be producing 500,000 jobs a month. It's just not happening. And the lesson is that it's very hard to pump up the economy short term with borrowing and spending and tax cuts. That's for the long term. The countries that have very small stimulus, like Germany, are growing really well. The countries with big stimulus like us, not growing well. Monetary policy is really the only way you can do that, and that's where Bernanke comes in.
And EJ, if you look at the accumulation of bad numbers that the administration is dealing with and the country is dealing with on housing, unemployment, manufacturing, all of it put together, where's the silver lining here for Democrats?
If there's a silver lining there, I haven't found it yet. I mean, this is just not good news, which is why I think it's unfortunate that Bernanke did what he did. And just by the way, on David's point, Germany is growing for other reasons. I don't think it's their fiscal policy. But what's unfortunate is in the beginning of this downturn, Bernanke was willing to take every risk on the side of pumping money into the economy because he thought it might collapse otherwise. Now he's showing some ambivalence. And if you think, as I do, that, and a lot of people do, that the risk of continued unemployment is higher than the risk of long-term inflation, you wish he had been more aggressive today. It's not like unemployment is at 7%, which would still be high. It's at 10%. And so I think President Obama, but also the economy overall, would have been better off if Bernanke had jumped today and done more.
Let's turn to politics, in particular this week's primaries on Tuesday. And on the Republican side, a couple of results that are worth talking about. In the Florida governor's race, in the Republican primary, you had State Attorney General Bill McCollum, who had the backing of the party. He lost to a rich outsider, Rick Scott. And then in Alaska, the final conclusion isn't set yet. They're waiting for absentee ballots. But Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski, part of the Republican Party establishment here in Washington, may have lost to an inexperienced politician, Joe Miller, who had Tea Party backing and that of Sarah Palin. David Brooks, what are the lessons you take for the Republican Party?
Well, Bill McCollum in Florida is plenty conservative guy, but he's got some establishment links, and that's apparently bad. And the same with Lisa Murkowski. She's pro-choice on abortion. That sort of hurt her. But more to the point, she's an appropriator. She's a sort of non-ideological deal-maker who brings pork back to Alaska.
Which Alaska
usually
tends to love.
Usually like that, but not this year, or at least not among these primary voters. And so she may have lost to a guy who was endorsed by Sarah Palin and who was much more ideological and came out really hard about health care. So it was a more ideological, philosophical rejection of the normal appropriator pork barrel politics.
But does that spell bad news for Republicans come November? Are they picking people in the primaries who don't stand a chance?
The real test there is Nevada, where Sharon Angle is now tied with Harry Reid, the majority leader, who looked like a dead duck and now is at least tied. So that's the test case. I doubt Alaska will go Democratic.
E.J. Dionne, the lesson for you from what we saw on Tuesday?
Well, I think the Republicans are going through an insurrection and the Democrats aren't. If you actually, there's been a lot of talk trying to merge one common theme out of these primaries, and there isn't a common theme. The Republicans are a very conservative party. Conservatives are on the march. By the way, if Alaska doesn't want all that money, they can send it our way to other states. And so I think on balance, this is a problem for Republicans. It's the same problem we're going to talk about with Glenn Beck. I think that if Democrats have a shot of pulling this thing out, containing their losses, it will be because the Republicans nominate candidates who are too right-wing, like Sharon Angle, like Rand Paul, and like these candidates on Tuesday.
You mentioned Glenn Beck. He is holding a rally here tomorrow here in Washington at the Lincoln Lincoln Memorial on the anniversary of Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech. Unclear how many Tea Party activists will come, but it's expected to be big. David, do you think the Tea Party is having a real effect on the Republican Party? Is it steering the boat?
Yeah, I'm thinking of going to the rally. I'm thinking of going with my New York Times polo shirt just to improve my speed in the 40-yard dash. Get the hell out of there.
I want pictures of that.
You know, I think they are having an effect. They are pulling the party back from a more even compassionate conservative to a more libertarian, to a more old right, more almost pre-Reagan. The government really has no business, even like in Social Security. Will they have a short-term effect politically in destroying Republican fortunes this year? I think the evidence is no. That the independent voters may not like the Tea Party, but they're still leaning Republican just because they're so upset about the spending and what the Democrats are doing.
E.J. Dionne, thoughts on Glenn Beck's rally and what it means?
Well, I think the most striking thing is that Democrats really want to talk about it a lot, and Republicans don't want to talk about it at all. Republicans know, again, that one of their barriers is if people like Beck and some of these other right-wingers, if they create an extremist image for the party's got a potential problem. Republicans want Beck to turn out their vote. They don't want him to start turning out the other side's vote. They're much better off if he's preaching to the converted on Fox News than to have him get wide publicity for statements like Barack Obama is a racist with a deep-seated hatred for white people, or that Obama's programs are reparations. The notion that he's having this rally on the anniversary of the Civil Rights Rally is really, to be very charitable, remarkable.
Okay. David, good luck with the race tomorrow. We're looking forward to hearing your results.
I'll root for you, David.
And thanks to you both for coming in. Thank you. David Brooks of The New York Times, N.E.G. Dionne of The Washington Post, and Brookings Institution.